You're listening to a podcast of a program produced in 2015 as part of Aloud, a series of dynamic conversations, readings, and performances that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic downtown Central Library in the heart of Los Angeles. These programs are presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles, which supports the Los Angeles Public Library. To support Aloud or learn about the entire podcast collection, please visit www.lfla.org/aloud. Those who waged the good battle in the fight against fundamentalism, which Karima Banoon chronicles in Your Fatwa Does Not Apply Here, are brave and also hopeful individuals. What grit does it take to stand in protest in Lahore, Pakistan, with a banner proclaiming no more blasphemy laws? Or as Young Women for Change did, to take to the streets of Kabul to denounce sexual harassment, undeterred by threats? You'll meet many other courageous trailblazers in this book from around the Muslim world, writers, activists, doctors, lawyers, and educators who often risk death to combat the rising tide of fundamentalism within their own countries. In her book, Banoon has, in the words of the great writer Wole Soyinka, redefined courage. This is a clarifying book, an inspiring book, a necessary book. We need Karima Banoon to remind us that, quote, the reality that governments have grossly abused human rights in the name of fighting terrorism does not make that fight any less important. It simply means we have to combat several forms of suffering simultaneously rather than tolerating either in the name of the other, which is a really nuanced and very important statement. Karima grew up in Algeria in the United States. She's a professor of international law at UC Davis School of Law. She's a former legal advisor for Amnesty International, and she lectures all over the world. Can't keep track of where she is. Her book received the 2014 Dayton Literary Peace Prize, which is a very high honor indeed. And our esteemed moderator tonight, Ani Zonneveld, is founder and president of Muslims for Progressive Values. She's a strong supporter of women and LGBTQ rights for freedom of expression and for freedom of and from belief. Her recent open letter, which I recommend you to read, to the new Saudi King Salma, which is on Al Jazeera America, lays out in no uncertain terms the cause of progressive Islam. She's the co-editor of an anthology, Progressive Muslim Identities, Personal Stories from the U.S. and Canada. And Karima Banoon's book is a very personal story, as I'm sure you'll hear. Her father was an outspoken professor at the University of Algiers who faced death threats during the 1990s, but he continued to speak out against fundamentalism and terror. She tells us that she feels no right to despair when those who are on the front lines of Muslim fundamentalism do not give up. Her late father was one of those people. He's told his daughter, the fundamentalists are condemned to disappear because they oppose not only hope, but love. Your Fatwa Does Not Apply Here stands on the legacy of that hope and that love. Please welcome Karima Banoon and Ani Zonneveld. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much for that wonderful introduction. I'm absolutely thrilled and honored to be here this evening with you in this beautiful library. And I am particularly thrilled that Ani Zonneveld has joined me. I am a big supporter of the work of her organization, Muslims for Progressive Values. And in fact, I got to write about them in the afterword for the new edition of my book, The Paperback, that came out in December. And I thought I would share what I wrote. What has kept me going as terror and obscurantism metastasize is the fact that the resistance escalates too. For example, Muslims for Progressive Values and its unstoppable Malaysian-American musician head Ani Zonneveld are convoking a global alliance of inclusive Muslims to question the right of the regressive Organization of Islamic Cooperation to speak for the faith internationally. In a June 2014 Geneva press conference, this new collective of progressive Muslims, as they call themselves, across all nationality, race, and sectarian affiliations, promised to challenge theological justifications for hate with what they call the progressive values inherent in Islam. They actually perform same-sex Muslim marriages. How can you not be inspired? So I'm really grateful to be here this evening with Ani and really grateful for the invitation by the library, and thanks to Louise, thanks to everyone here at Aloud. So I basically am feeling quite a sense of urgency. There is a real feeling of desperation. Ani and I were talking about that this afternoon, and I think many of us who are working on these issues are feeling that. And before I get to the stories, which I hope will bring us back to hope and to optimism, which is the only responsible place, I think, to end up in my remarks in our discussion this evening. But before I get there, we need to understand, I think, all of us, the gravity of what we're dealing with. And this may be absolutely obvious in light of the headlines, in light of the headlines today. But we are, in fact, now facing a widespread threat to the culture of most Muslim-majority societies, to the open, tolerant Islam of my grandfather, of so many of our grandparents, from extremist movements, from what I call Muslim fundamentalist movements. And I think we really have to understand just how deep that threat is. We are facing the possibility of mass religious cleansing, borrowing from the term ethnic cleansing, mass religious cleansing of religious minorities from the Muslim majority regions of the world, with the possible mass flight of Christians from North Africa, from the Levant, in the face of extremist violence, which targets many people, including that community. We are also facing the possibility of religious minorities departing in more significant numbers than they have recently from Europe, particularly Jews leaving France in the face of Muslim fundamentalist violence against the Jewish community there. We are facing the possibility that even having an event like this one this evening is going to become more and more difficult. I mean, think about it. It was just less than 2 months ago that a Danish filmmaker was shot in Copenhagen and killed, the filmmaker Finn Norgaard, at a discussion about these issues on the topic of freedom of speech specifically. And in fact, many of the very outspoken anti-fundamentalist voices now require security to be able to speak in public. This is what I was told over the weekend by some former Charlie Hebdo staffers when I was in Paris. They can't go speak anywhere now without security. The security cost has to be borne in most countries by organizations. Organizations can't often afford that. And that means that, including in the West, a whole set of voices may be left out of our debates if we are not vigilant. We are also, meanwhile, facing the rise of the far right in the West. If you look at how well the National Front did in France in the elections while I was there, the local elections, and these are movements that are also promoting hatred and certainly promoting discrimination against Muslims and against immigrants. We are facing the reality that we will leave younger generations in a context where they are surrounded by these far right movements on all sides, that is, the Muslim far right and the Western far right. Now, because of this rise of the far right in the West, many people, and I was just on a speaking tour in Europe, many people, despite all of these threats, are actually unwilling to speak critically in public about these issues for fear of blending in with racist discourses. So we are, as I describe it in my book, really walking on a tightrope here. And still the jihad continues. It has been a ghastly few days. Ani and I were talking about that this afternoon. My talk here this evening really is dedicated to some of the victims of the last few days. First, to the reported 70, we don't know the final number yet, the reported 70 hostages, mainly college students, and I think about this a lot as a university professor, college students who were killed earlier today by Al-Shabaab gunmen in northeastern Kenya at Garissa University. Especially horrifying, we were discussing this afternoon, is the news that Al-Shabaab told the BBC quite openly that it was releasing Muslim hostages and holding Christians captive. So it was practicing a kind of terror apartheid, as it did at the Westgate Mall in Nairobi. And so I dedicate my talk this evening to those student victims. And I would also like to dedicate it to a 27-year-old Bangladeshi blogger, and I'm hoping I can bring up his picture for you there. There he is. 27-year-old Bangladeshi blogger named Mohammed Oyasikur Rahman Babu, who was hacked to death on the streets of Dhaka, Bangladesh on Monday by radical Islamists, likely due to his anti-radical, anti-Islamist views that he regularly had the courage to express on Facebook and elsewhere. The only bright part of this otherwise appalling story is the report that several of the fleeing assailants were detained by local transgendered persons in the community when others were reluctant to intervene. And they were the ones who heroically turned two of the attackers into the police. And I really honor that amazing courage. So how then can we stop this kind of jihad that claimed the Bangladeshi blogger, that claimed the students in Kenya, and so many others? I mean, these are just a few cases that I'm citing here. How can we turn the tide in favor of tolerance? These are the questions that I hope we will explore throughout the evening tonight, and they're questions that I've been grappling with in my work. And my own modest contribution to trying to do that, to turn the tide here, has been to document the work and the words of those like the valiant transgendered Bangladeshis who stopped the two killers in Dhaka, those who have stood up on the front lines against extremism and terror, often when they themselves had the most to lose. And I think one of the critical things that I want you to take away from this evening, this is something I said a lot when I was in Europe last week, is that what we really need is a paradigm shift in how we think about this. Since at least President Obama's speech to the General Assembly back in September of last year about ISIS, there has really been this idea that somehow the West has figured out that Muslim fundamentalism is a bad thing and now needs to convince Muslims to join them in working against it. And in fact, my research taught me, as indeed my life experience did, as well as Louise mentioned, that is precisely the opposite of what has occurred. That in fact, it was many Muslims and people of Muslim heritage, decades before the West was concerned about this problem, who recognized the very grave threat that Muslim fundamentalist movements and their violence posed, really the almost existential threat that they posed to their countries, to their cultures, to their communities. And unfortunately, the West really failed to support them. So I'm really suggesting here we need to shift our paradigm, and instead of saying, you know, why are they not joining us, the question really is, what can we do to join them? They have been leading this struggle already. President Obama said, I think quite rightly, that it is time for the world to explicitly, forcefully, and consistently reject the ideology of Al-Qaeda and ISIL, as he called it. And I have to say, for me, as a person very proud of their Muslim heritage, I concur entirely, and I hope that this call will be heeded from Doha to Detroit. There is absolutely no way to fight jihadist terrorism without undercutting its ideological base. I think about someone I interviewed, the wonderful Sharifa Kadar, an Algerian advocate who works with victims of terrorism in her country, where about 200,000 people fell to fundamentalist armed groups back in the 1990s. More about that later. She said to me, you cannot defeat terrorism by an anti-terrorist battle without doing the anti-fundamentalist battle. So she really agreed with that call in the president's speech for taking on the ideology. I think also about what a man named Jamil Omar told me, and I can't show you his picture for security reasons. He's a former trade unionist and an anti-militancy campaigner in Pakistan with the Awami Jamhuri Forum. And he was facing such persistent threats when I met him that he tried not to spend too much time near colleagues because he knew that he might endanger them. He told me that the core task ahead was, quote, challenging fundamentalist thought. And I think that's so essential. He noted that this would not be an easy struggle, but he said that Muslim societies, in his view, would only come of age when they are willing to challenge fundamentalism and to reclaim what he called the rational, secular, golden past. So I do think, again, that President Obama's call to tackle the political ideology of Islamism once and for all is something that should be welcomed. We just have to stress that, in fact, many people of Muslim heritage were out in front, way out in front of the American president, and have been putting their lives on the line for years to confront this ideology. Liberal, secular, moderate, left-wing, feminist advocates in Muslim-majority countries have been calling on the world to understand the danger that they were facing from these movements. And instead, they watched the United States and Britain support the archaic Gulf monarchies that export Wahhabism to all Muslim-majority regions of the world with their petrodollars. The U.S. unfortunately also spearheaded an effort that trained jihadists from Morocco to Indonesia in its Cold War struggle against the Soviet Union in Afghanistan, and this helped the problem to metastasize. In my father's home country of Algeria in the 1990s, the worst jihadist killers we called the Afghans because they had fought in Afghanistan in the quote-unquote jihad against the Soviet Union with American support, Saudi support, Pakistani intelligence support, and they came home with that training, and they came home with their ideological beliefs hardened. Now, there are really important internal and external causes of fundamentalism in these regions. I am not at all a fan of the ridiculous conspiracy theories that suggest somehow this whole problem came from the West. That's not what I'm saying. But what I am saying is that here in the West, it is important for us to acknowledge our own portion of the responsibility. In fact, I think, ironically, the West has really internalized Islamist discourse. And note, Islamist is not at all the same thing as Islam. As I say in the book, the three extra letters make a critical difference. Islam is one of the world's great religious traditions, like Christianity, Judaism, Hinduism, Buddhism, and so on, that is practiced in many ways by many people around the world, more than a billion people, and at least 1.5 billion people are of Muslim heritage. They may have different kinds of relationships to the faith, just like people in any tradition. So Islam and Islamism are not the same thing, but I do think that the West has internalized, normalized in a way, the Islamist view of what Islam is and what Muslims are like. You all too often hear somehow the idea that all Muslim women are veiled, and that religion is the only and overarching identity and factor across these regions, that there is something called a Muslim view. There's no such thing about any question, just like there isn't a Christian view, that there is something called the Muslim community that is somehow monolithic and headed by certain specific unelected leaders. That, too, is an Islamist construct of what they call the ummah, right? The community of Muslim believers. That is an Islamist view, not necessarily a view shared by many, many Muslims and people of Muslim heritage around the world. So I think part of what we really have to do is to challenge a lot of our thinking and our assumptions here. I also challenge my fellow people of Muslim heritage, absolutely. And I don't want you to mistake me. I am saying that many people have been doing this work, but I still maintain that many more of us need to do so, especially those of us who are living safely in the diasporas in the West, where we do have possibilities to express ourselves on these issues. Some people, like Ani and her wonderful organization, have been doing that, but not enough of us have been speaking out. And I really think of Asma Jahangir, a Pakistani human rights lawyer who has to have armed guards in her office in Lahore, and really begged me to say to people in the diaspora, you know, please do more to speak up and join us. The fundamentalists have transnational support. We need it too. I think one of the things that has disappointed me in recent months has been the suggestion put forward by some prominent Muslim American comics, we've heard it from prominent Muslim American bloggers, that somehow we don't have an obligation to speak out, and why should anybody ask us to speak out? I desperately want to speak out. I don't really understand that point of view because I see thousands of people dying. I see a way of life, a culture in which I grew up, under threat from extremist movements. I see rising discrimination against Muslims in the backlash to what these movements are claiming wrongfully to be doing in the name of Islam. And I don't need anyone to ask me to speak out. I want to speak out. I do feel a responsibility to speak out, not because there is any collective guilt, but because by speaking out, we might be able to make a difference. We might be able to support those on the front lines who are doing so. I think about what the wonderful Tahmina Kazi of the British Muslims for Secular Democracy told me back in the fall after the killing of a British hostage by ISIS. She said it is no longer enough to simply condemn British militants who join the Islamic State with words. We have to do much more. And she was calling for building a critical mass of Muslim opposition voices and promoting positive British Muslim role models for youth, which is something that she herself was very much involved in. So now I want to jump forward and actually tell you a little bit more here about the book. So I decided to take on this issue by writing this book, by trying to go out and find the people who were doing what my father was doing in Algeria back in the 1990s. So my dad was a professor of anthropology at the University of Algiers in what was called the Dark Decade, when about 200,000 Algerians, and I think I have a slide here of some of them, 200,000 Algerians, including every one of the women that you see here, was killed by fundamentalist armed groups battling against the state. And in that environment, my father made the decision that come what may, despite the threats, threats on our kitchen table, threats on the mailbox, he would keep speaking out. It was too important. And he wrote articles condemning what he called the radical break of the terrorists with the Islam as it had been lived by our ancestors. And what was really heartbreaking to me was how little attention people like him got. Everybody knew that somebody was blowing something up in Algeria. Everybody knew about the terrorists, but they didn't know about the people who were standing up to the terrorists. They didn't know about the women protesters who would go out the next day and fill the bomb craters in pavement that was still wet from being washed where the human remains had been. They would fill the bomb craters with flowers, and there they would be. And people would hear maybe a headline about the bombings, but they wouldn't hear about those people. And I really wanted to change that. So I went out to meet as many people as I could, and I ended up interviewing about 300 people of Muslim heritage from nearly 30 countries, from Afghanistan to Mali. And here you see me actually doing an interview in Mali. And I tried to understand what their experience had been, why they stood up, how they stood up, what they wanted the international community to do. The people I met were really remarkable people. Here you see Aminatou Daouda, whom I met in Niger, who is the daughter of an imam, of a religious leader, and she promotes the CEDAW, the UN Women's Convention, and believes that treaty to be entirely reconcilable with her Muslim faith. And I met Maria Bashir. Maria Bashir is the first and only woman chief prosecutor in Afghanistan, who now has to have 23 bodyguards because she has not only received threats, but has actually survived attempts to kill her, one of which took the leg off of one of her bodyguards. And yet she continues the work. And she still fears that the international community is about to sell out women's rights defenders like her in its bid to, quote, reconcile with the Taliban. That's the terminology you hear in Washington. And I also met the great Deep Saida of the Pakistan Institute for Peace and Secularism Studies, who organizes demonstrations against Taliban abuses and virtually any terrorist atrocity that you can think of. The attack on Malala Yousafzai, the church bombings recently in Lahore. Deep, who's right there in the middle, is out there in the streets holding her protest sign. This is a rally that I saw in 2010 against the sentencing to death of a Christian Pakistani woman for blasphemy shortly before I arrived there. And in this photo, you see Muslims and Christians, atheists, free thinkers, and believers side by side denouncing the blasphemy law, calling for a secular state. And in fact, they were told, Deep was told on the phone, that if they had this protest, suicide bombers would come. And she said, you know, come if you must, but we will be there. And there they stood on the pavement. And it's one thing I say in the book, you know, Pakistani terrorists, that has sort of become a stereotype. Unfortunately, there's a certain reality underlying it. But Pakistani peace activists, that's not a stereotype. And that is also a reality. So we really have to complicate our thinking about all of these questions. I think about another gentleman whose picture I unfortunately can't show you. His name, he asked me to call him Mr. Bodmar. He is a school teacher from the north of Mali who, during the jihadist occupation by allies of Al-Qaeda of the north of his country in 2012, risked his life to keep his school open and to continue educating boys and girls side by side in the same classroom. And I asked him why he did that. He could have fled the north like everybody else. And he said, what you see here, my presence creates hope for my students. I cannot kill this hope. Or I think about Raif Bedawi, who you may know. He may be the one person in this litany that you do know. Unfortunately, we didn't know about him early enough to save him from what he is now suffering. Raif Bedawi is a blogger in Saudi Arabia. He runs the Liberal Saudi Network, and for that grave crime, in quotes, has been sentenced to 10 years in jail and 1,000 lashes to be administered 50 at a time, and that has already begun. Now, Ani and I were both campaigning on his case before the punishment began, and it was very hard to get anyone interested. Since the flogging began, thankfully, there is more international interest, and so far the punishment has not continued, but it could continue at any time. And I was so disappointed when President Obama went to Saudi Arabia to welcome the new king that, at least in public, he did not say anything about this case, because it seems to me that it is so critical to speak out in support of those who are championing liberal values in the face of such violence and such extremism. And so you meet these people, or in the case of Raif, I've been in touch with his family, and you ask yourself, why is it that people like this are not more recognized internationally? I mean, why is it that everyone knows who Osama bin Laden was, but so few people know of those standing up to the bin Ladens in each context? Why is that? I mean, that's a question I honestly don't have the answer for you. I am continuing to look for that answer, and I am trying to contribute in my own small way to changing that. And I will do that tonight by, that's my father, I already talked about him. I will do that tonight by telling a few stories, but I was sort of overambitious. I always write a talk that's about three times as long as the time, because I love these people's stories. I'm so inspired by them. But I, being a professor, have to stop quickly and just define the term that I'm using here. People call this phenomenon a number of things: Islamism, radicalism, extremism, euphemism. I mean, there's a whole debate about what to call it. I use the term fundamentalism, and I use the definition from the Algerian sociologist Mariamme Elie Lucas, who says that fundamentalisms are political movements of the extreme right that basically manipulate religion to achieve their political aims. And the nice thing about this definition with the S on the end is it reminds us that Islam is not the only one of the world's great religious traditions afflicted by this problem, although it is taking a particularly vicious and ubiquitous form in many Muslim-majority contexts today. So that is the term that I use. That is what I am talking about. And I think one of the real challenges that we have right now is that in the West, we basically have a choice of two discourses, for the most part, about this topic, neither of which I find very helpful at all. The first that you find increasingly on the right, and especially on the far right in the West, is the discriminatory take on this, that somehow all Muslims, or most Muslims, support the fundamentalists or are sort of approving of what's happening, or that there's something inherently fundamentalist about Islam. And that's just offensive and completely inaccurate. But then, unfortunately, on the left, sometimes in response to that discourse on the right, what you sometimes hear is a kind of apologetic response or a politically correct response that doesn't even want to address the topic at all. And I think that that, too, actually does a very grave disservice to the people on the front line. So what I'm looking for is an entirely different way of talking about this and thinking about this that is based on the analysis and the work and the words and the hope of the people living on the front lines of this issue, so that we can actually have a reasonable, critical, non-racist, non-stereotypical, but also completely honest debate and discussion about what is going on. And I think one of the critical ways to do that, again, is to tell these stories of the people doing this work. So I had so many stories. I was completely overambitious about how many stories I was going to tell. But I think I will just tell one from Iraq. And if anybody wants to know who any of these other people are in the Q&A, I can come back to them. So this is a story that I think is so important to think about now. This is the story of Yanar Mohammed. And I had the great privilege of interviewing Yanar Mohammed back in 2010 when she came to the U.S. to a conference. She is the founder of what is called the Organization of Women's Freedom in Iraq, and you see their website up there at the top if you are interested. Yanar was an opponent of the 2003 U.S. invasion of Iraq, and I think at the time of that invasion, Egypt's President Hosni Mubarak, a close American ally, was right when he said that the war in Iraq would spawn 100 new bin Ladens, and he was right at least about that. That's exactly what happened. So Iraq was transformed from a brutal but more secular dictatorship into basically a chaotic haven for fundamentalist terrorists. And it was in that environment that Yanar Mohammed created the Organization of Women's Freedom in Iraq and began working against sectarianism, began working against violence and for women's rights, and for that began to receive death threats so systematically that she had to wear a bulletproof vest about 24 hours a day that doubled her girth. So very uncomfortable. But she wouldn't give up the work. She continued. And she and her colleagues today are from inside Iraq denouncing the violence of ISIS. It's one thing to do it outside, it's another thing to do it inside. But not only that, they are running helplines for Iraqi women who are falling victim to the violence of ISIS and other groups, and they actually are running shelters for women in Baghdad. And think about what an incredibly courageous thing that is to do. And you ask yourself again, in all the coverage of ISIS and its atrocities in Iraq, why are we not hearing about this incredibly important work? Why are we not supporting this work? Or you can think about the wonderful, heroic Samira Anaimi, an Iraqi lawyer from Mosul, who spoke out on Facebook against ISIS destruction of historic sites in her home city and was picked up by them in September of last fall, tortured for 4 days, and then publicly executed in her home city. And I'm so glad that we know the faces and the stories of our tragically lost American hostages who were killed by ISIS, but I don't understand why we don't recognize Samira, why we didn't see her face on television, why we don't hear her story. And that, I think, we absolutely have to change. I will never forget something that a Pakistani sociologist and UN expert named Farida Shahid told me back in Lahore, Pakistan, when I was working on this. She said the greatest support would be for the alternative voices to be heard wherever they are. And I thank you so much for joining us tonight so that we can move forward a little bit in that process. Thank you.
Hi, good evening. That was an excellent talk, Karima. And thank you for that generous introduction. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Annie Zonneveld, and I'm going to facilitate the discussion tonight, and we'll be opening up the floor to Q&A, and I'm sure you have lots of questions. But I'd like to start probably the conversation with Karima. Let's start first with this freedom of speech, or the lack of it, and the issue of blasphemy in much of the Muslim world, and how that is basically the controlling factor, not just by the governments, but also by the radical Muslims and their ideology. And those caught in the middle are those Muslims who have been speaking up, and those that you've highlighted so generously and honored their lives in your books. So how do you think that we, the Muslims that are in the center, that are being attacked on both ends, not just by the radicals, but also by the state institutions, the governments, the oppressive governments that do so in the name of religion?
That's a great question. I mean, I think freedom of expression is an absolutely critical piece of this debate, and we are seeing threats to the ability to even talk about this coming from a number of directions. One direction, obviously, is blasphemy laws, or as we see in Pakistan, for example, where people can be sentenced to death, or sort of ad hoc blasphemy laws. We saw in Afghanistan this horrible incident just a few weeks ago where there was a rumor spread about a particular Afghan woman who was herself, I believe, a religious scholar, the rumor that she had burned the Quran. It was completely unfounded. And even if she had, and a mob came and murdered her on the street, and there were a number of Afghan women who were so outraged by this, they actually went out. This is a very heroic thing to do on the streets of Kabul, and they buried her. You can see the pictures. Men usually bury women and men in Afghanistan, and you can see the pictures of doing that. So I think there are all these ways of policing speech and expression that are actually making lots of people afraid to even talk about religion. One of the Pakistani human rights advocates that I interviewed said that she will not have a discussion about religion with anyone now, because she is so worried that somebody could misconstrue something that she'd said or use as a tool against her these blasphemy laws. The other thing I have to say is this idea of sort of offense, right? This came up a lot after the Charlie Hebdo massacre. Much of that quote-unquote offense is politically constructed, right? People didn't sit back. I mean, most of the people who were offended by the Charlie Hebdo cartoons hadn't seen them, right? This was politically constructed offense, stage managed by fundamentalist groups. That was what happened with the Danish cartoons in the first place, right? There were a group of Danish Muslim fundamentalists who took the cartoons, and one can like or dislike or critique or support the cartoons. That's not my point. But they took the cartoons and they traveled around, actually mixing some other cartoons in them that had not been drawn by the Danish journalists. And they traveled around basically stirring up anger about them. So it's very also important to note how many Muslims out there and people of Muslim heritage are not offended by free expression and challenging expression, including about religion, including about the Prophet. I think about a wonderful guy named Faizan Pirzada, who I interviewed, who was a very religious guy and a theater promoter in Pakistan. And he said, I think if the Prophet Muhammad had seen these cartoons, he would have had a laugh. We don't get to hear those voices often enough, and I think we really need to keep challenging and pushing back and defending the freedom to even have the discussion about this.
Freedom to think. But I wanted to also say that growing up, I'm a Muslim, born, raised, and my Islam that I was raised on is the very Southeast Asian, it's Malaysian. And growing up, if you wanted to dispose of sacred texts, because you had to learn how to write sacred texts, you burn it. And so the fact that there's such a big deal about burning the Quran, that doesn't jive with my upbringing of Islam. So that was very contradictory, let's put it that way. Me and you support freedom of speech, even those that are blasphemous. How do we deal with even progressive faith institutions, for example, that cozy up with what we would define as hate-mongering imams? And there is one specific event that's happening in the UK that's being hosted by all people, the Quakers, and they're hosting some incredibly homophobic, intolerant, misogynistic imams in the UK. And that is just one example, but we've seen this many times over in the last few years, or since 9/11. How do we address that with our fellow progressive faith institutions?
You know, I think this is such an important question to be talking about, because I think it's a wonderful thing when people want to reach out and they want to build interfaith bridges and they want to increase understanding. But you also have to be very thoughtful. As I said at dinner tonight, if you're too open-minded, your brain will fall out, right? That's the old adage. You have to be very thoughtful about who you're partnering with, who you're engaging with. And please remember that while there may be a struggle between the right and the left here, you know, Muslims, people of Muslim heritage also have their own progressive struggles going on against their own extreme right, right? Mohamed Sifawi, an Algerian journalist based in Paris who I interviewed, said, look, I always have to explain to people, this is our extreme right, and we too have to fight them. And if in pursuit of interfaith dialogue, you're partnering up with the far right, you really risk undermining the progressives and the liberals in Muslim contexts who are challenging these movements. And this happens a lot. We saw this, for example, in Britain, where a number of human rights groups partnered with an organization called, that used to be called Cage Prisoners, it's now called Cage. You probably saw them on TV a lot during the whole Jihadi John coverage, when we found out at least who they think Jihadi John is, the British ISIS murderer. And many human rights groups worked with Cage Prisoners, thinking they were a, quote, human rights group. They were campaigning for the detainees, the human rights of detainees in Guantanamo, which certainly is an entirely legitimate task, except that they were actually also campaigning for the ideology of the detainees, some of the detainees at least, in Guantanamo. They were campaigning for the release of some jihadist detainees in democratic countries who had been tried, given fair trials, and were in fact imprisoned for terrorist-related offenses. And a number of South Asian women's rights activists really challenged the human rights groups. You know, what are you doing? We too don't agree with the way that people are being treated in Guantanamo. But we're also not naive about who some, not all, but who some of these people are. And while we will fight for their human rights in detention, when they come out of detention, we will also be working to challenge them. And I was glad to see, because of the bravery of a woman named Geeta Sehgal, who from within inside Amnesty International in particular challenged this. Just a few weeks ago, it's been announced that Amnesty will no longer work with cage prisoners. It's about time. And I just really want to make an appeal to people. Please do continue to try to reach out. But please inform yourself about to whom you are reaching out and what the politics are within the context so that you can have a positive effect by doing that rather than a negative one.
Thank you for that. with the work that Muslims for Progressive Value does at the United Nations, we advocate for human rights, and we defend the human rights defenders in Muslim-majority countries, particularly when the offense is done in the name of Sharia law. And a lot of times we come up across a real hesitant to use the language of religion. Oftentimes, like the human rights institutions, the secular ones, want to use the secular language. Whereas when the human rights abuses are done in the name of Sharia, we as a Muslim organization feel it is probably not necessary all the time, more effective to use the same language of religion to counter that particular ideology, that particular justification for it. And what was really interesting is, I think, with the backdrop of ISIL that we've seen, there is a little bit more openness to using the language of religion, particularly Sharia law, a positive language in defending human rights. But I also find that what Karima alluded to earlier on, how Pakistanis or people of Muslim tradition, culture themselves, are afraid to use the language of religion in their home country because there's a real high chance of them getting hauled to jail. I know that's the case in Malaysia and obviously in Pakistan and Afghanistan and much of the Arab world. And this lack of freedom to think and to express oneself, I think, is probably the downfall of the Muslim world.
My view about this is that both those who work within a religious discourse and those who work in other discourses, secular discourse, human rights discourse, can make a significant contribution to this fight. And it depends on the context as to which language I think can be more effective. And one of the women that I interviewed, Mariame Ali Lucas, the Algerian sociologist whose definition of fundamentalisms I use in the book, told me how critical she thinks it is that those doing the sort of religious reinterpretation work, the really important work that you're doing within religious perspectives, and those working in other perspectives, secular human rights, women's human rights perspectives, work together, partner, find ways to build alliances, because the opponents that we face are so very powerful. But I think it's really important to understand the religious discourse doesn't always work for everyone. I think about a wonderful Senegalese sociologist that I interviewed, Fatou Sow, and she said, look, I completely understand for people who are working in the Gulf, where in fact Sharia law is allegedly what is being implemented by the state, I understand that the discourse they find to be useful is a discourse of religious reinterpretation. But she said, and she is herself a religious believer, she said, for me as a Senegalese, she's living in an ostensibly secular country, she said, for me as a Senegalese, I refuse to reinterpret the Quran when I'm having a debate about the family law, right? I want to talk about the Constitution. So I think it really depends on the specific context. And I think we shouldn't over-inscribe religion in the debate, but we should also respect the role that religion can play. I think about the wonderful letter put out by religious scholars totally demolishing ISIS's theological justifications last fall. I do think that's incredibly important. But as we were discussing earlier, another thing to note, sometimes people think, oh, well, it has to be a religious discourse because the fundamentalists won't listen to secular discourse. They're not going to listen to the religious discourse either, to be honest, because they think that the liberal clergy are basically sellouts, right? And in fact, in some places, they are targeting the liberal clergy. So if you look across the Caucasus, for example, there have been huge numbers of killings of liberal imams who have spoken out and denounced the jihadists. So, I think about what Hina Jalani told me, another brilliant Pakistani human rights lawyer. She said, look, in my country, there are 78 interpretations of religion. I'm not sure that having a 79th will necessarily change things. From my perspective, she said, what I want to say, what I think shakes people up is, look, this is the modern world. We have certain modern problems, and we have to find modern solutions for them. And religion is very sacred, but it is a personal matter. And those solutions, unfortunately, are not going to come from that source. So I think we have to make room for the different strategies and the different discourses.
So speaking about the 123 scholars that wrote an open letter to so-called Caliphate of Baghdadi, what I would like to challenge them is to actually implement much of what they were advocating for in their home countries. So let's talk about ideology. So the war cannot be won by bombs and guns. And much has been talked about, well, we need to get to the root, the crux of it, and that is the theology, the ideology of what spurs this violent interpretation. There are many Muslim organizations throughout the world that have been challenging the interpretation, this Wahhabi interpretation, but what is really lacking, the support of those institutions, the reading materials, the educational materials, in order to change the minds. And this is the stumbling block. It's easy to get guns, it's easy to go bomb a country, but it's actually much harder to get funding to buy books and to educate people. How do we convince the policymakers of our countries, in the West particular, who are actually, based on my conversations with a lot of the EU governments, and as have you, and their fear of their youth joining ISIL, as we've seen in many of the European countries. And they're really grappling on how to figure out this identity issues that their Muslim youth are having. And this goes back to the crux. This goes back to the issue of education and how this education, this reinterpretation of Islam in a Western context is that hang, that hook from which they can hang their new European Muslim identity or American Muslim identity on.
So I'm going to start off by saying something perhaps politically incorrect and not very Northern Californian, right? I teach at UC Davis. And, you know, there's the slogans very popular. It's certainly very popular at UC Davis. War is not the answer. I think that's mostly true. But I do think that, unfortunately, sometimes when you have heavily armed movements, genocidal movements, which ISIS certainly is, if you look at the way that they have targeted, say, Yazidis, systematically targeting huge numbers of civilians. Another example, northern Nigeria, people do have the right to be protected, including by the use of force. And sometimes, unfortunately, that use of force will be necessary to protect those civilians. But, and this is the very important but, it absolutely has to be used in accordance with international law. What I am saying is absolutely no justification for violations of human rights, violations of the UN Charter, violations of international humanitarian law. You know, in my book, I have this section called How the Right and the Left Both Get This Wrong. And I think on this part of the issue, you know, the mistake on the right, particularly after 9/11, was to presume that the rules on the use of force no longer apply when you're fighting terrorism. That's a terrible mistake. That got us into Iraq, and what a disaster that was. But I think the mistake on the left was to assume that force should never be used against totalitarian armed movements targeting civilians. And I don't agree with that either. My position is somewhere in the middle. But, and I think this is another very important but, even when it is justifiable to use force, force can only ever be the tip of the iceberg, the smallest piece of the response. You need an educational response, an economic response, a social response, an ideological response, a political response, a response on all these levels. And you have to be very thoughtful about how you use force, or you can just make the problem absolutely worse, which is a lot of what we have seen. We don't spend enough on education. I interviewed in the book this wonderful woman named Sakina Yakubi, who is the head of something called the Afghan Institute of Learning, based in Herat in far western Afghanistan. And she said, you know, when I look at the money that the international community gives to programs like mine, I really ask, are you serious about democracy in my country? Because nobody wants to fund, you know, what she's doing, running these amazing schools, teaching tolerance. I remember being in one of their classrooms, I talk about it in the book, sitting on the ground with boys and girls together in the classroom with a young Afghan woman school teacher in jeans, you know, teaching English, and you know, you think this is really incredibly important for the future of this country, and yet, you know, it is so hard to get funding for a program like this. So I think education is almost everywhere that I went when I asked people what is the best way to combat fundamentalism, almost always the first answer was education. But of course, it depends what kind of education, because the fundamentalists understand very well how powerful it is, and they target, just as the Christian fundamentalists do in this country, they target education. They go after curricula. They always want to take over the Ministry of Education when they have any opportunity to move into government at all. And so it's not just any education. It is a sort of pro-tolerance, humanist education that is absolutely critical.
Inclusive worldview. That's what we want. Last question that we're going to have between us, and then we'll open it up to the floor. How do you, in your case, deal with this constant barrage of bad news and being, you know, immersed in this human rights abuses? And how do you stay hopeful? Do you write? Do you vent out with poetry? Do you sing? Do you what do you do?
You know, it's very hard sometimes. Sometimes, you know, you and I both felt, I think today, looking at the news from Kenya, and when I heard the story of the young blogger from Bangladesh, just really overwhelmed. I remember, I think I was actually on the phone with you when we found out that Alan Henning had been killed, the British aid worker. And I remember you just saying, my God, what else can we try? I mean, many people, many Muslim organizations tried many different things to secure his release, and nothing seemed to make any difference. You know, what else can we try? The place that I found my hope is in the unflagging determination of the people on the ground who are facing such a more difficult battle than I am. And I talk about in the book, I really don't feel any right to despair when they keep going. And I think about, you know, I interviewed this amazing Afghan women's rights activist whose security situation was so bad at the time I interviewed her in Kabul that she asked me not to use her name. And she said to me something that has really stayed with me. She said, optimism is key to survival. And I think that's absolutely critical. And so when I get really down, I go back and look at some of those interviews. Or there's something that I often turn to, which is actually an Egyptian film I highly recommend, which is called El Masir, or Destiny in English. And I describe it in the book as the greatest anti-fundamentalist musical of all time. And it is about Ibn Rushd, the great 12th century Andalusian theologian and rationalist who believed that reason and faith were not only reconcilable, but that in fact, if you were a person of faith, you had to exercise reason because it was a God-given gift. And it is an absolutely beautiful musical. And there is a song, Ali Sotak, raise your voice. And the lyrics basically are, raise your voice while singing is still possible. And so when going back and reading some of the interviews and looking at the faces, sometimes the pictures of the people in the book isn't enough, I turn to musical. And I highly recommend, if you can get your hands on a copy of Destiny, to watch it, and you will be convinced. This is a movie from 1997. You will be convinced that, in fact, people in the Muslim world, people in Muslim-majority contexts, were worried about this issue, unfortunately, long before we had recognized here that it was a concern. And they're still going.
Yep. With that, shall we open the floor up to questions? Oh, I see several. Our microphones are floating around now.
Thank you, Sean. Thank you for your remarks. It was very enlightening. My two-part question is, how should the United States change its foreign policy? And as a sub-question, how should it change its policy, if at all, towards Saudi Arabia, our good friend, but the major funder and sponsor of
Wahhabism. Yes.
Wahhabism, right. Yes.
Three questions, and then we'll answer them.
It's kind of a two-part question, but part of it was, I'll start with this one first because it's related to that, and that is, how much of the funding and the ideology of the relationship, ancient relationship, or between the Saudis and the Iranians is fueling a lot of this fundamentalism and aggression that's going on in the Middle East at this point? And the second one was, how much is this a part that each of the countries that make up a lot of the countries that are in revolt at this point in the Middle East, how much of each of those is individualistic to each specific country?
A Could you comment on the role of social media and its impact in terms of promoting the imagery and the so-called message of fundamentalism?
You want to answer first?
Thank you for these great questions. I don't want to talk for too long, so I will just sort of try to give a few thoughts in response to each of them. How should the U.S. change its foreign policy? That's, of course, a very easy question. No, I'm kidding. I mean, it's a very complicated question. But I think on this issue, one of the key things that we need to do is to stop thinking that we can fight so-called violent extremism with so-called nonviolent extremism. This is an extremely dangerous construct that we have tried. We have, I think, worked closely often with the Muslim Brotherhood. When you look at who gets invited to things like the White House Summit on Combating Violent Euphemism, violent extremism, as it was called, because they didn't want to sort of offend anybody by labeling it any more specifically, you know, people like Ani and I did not get invited to that meeting. People with a much more conservative view, sometimes people very close to the Muslim Brotherhood, who I think helped to promote the ideology that gives rise to this violence, were invited in part to that meeting and to others. They are seen somehow as the partners. You'll hear sometimes from State Department and former State Department people that the way to make peace in Afghanistan is to, quote, reconcile with the moderate Taliban. I mean, this is just nonsensical. I put this question to some of the Afghan women's rights defenders in my book, you know, what do you think about this construct, moderate Taliban? And Horia Mossadegh said to me, just outraged, this is somebody who had her nose broken by the Taliban during their reign in Kabul because she went into a fabric store and actually lifted her burqa to try to see the material she was trying to buy. And she said, look, if someone is moderate, why would they be Taliban? If somebody's moderate, they're anti-Taliban. This is a ridiculous construct. So I think that's one of the critical things we have to recognize. The real moderates are the people who are working against extremism and who have non-extremist views and who are willing to challenge extremism. We are often seen as controversial. You're told somebody is controversial. That means they're actually speaking out on this issue. And I think we have to be unembarrassed and unafraid of partnering with and working with and listening to and empowering those voices as we have not been doing. On Saudi Arabia, it was noticed, of course, all over the region that not only President Obama, but many Western leaders went to Saudi Arabia to welcome King Salman and said almost nothing about the human rights record in the country at a time when they were flogging a young blogger. The world noticed. The world knows why we all did that. Of course, that was for reasons that have to do with economic interests. It is an incredibly short-sighted strategy, and it really, I think, causes a great deal of anger across these regions. Everywhere I went, from Mali to Pakistan, people ranted and raved to me about how upset they were about the impact of money coming from the Gulf countries, most often from Saudi Arabia, nowadays from Qatar, sometimes indeed from Iran, sometimes coming in the form of quote-unquote humanitarian aid, but going to foster certain organizations that were pushing forward a more and more extreme view of religion. So I think, you know, we've partnered with some of these governments in the war against ISIS. It doesn't make any sense. I mean, they are responsible, actually, for helping to globalize the ideological matrix in which ISIS is even possible. So I think if we really want to take a long view, we are going to have to question those relationships, and we're going to have to build relationships in the region with people who actually do not want theocracy, and there are many of them.
I want to add also to the issue of Wahhabi versus Shiaism and how the conflict has basically destroyed and the death and destruction in the Middle East. But it's not just staying in the Middle East. It's obviously in Pakistan and Afghanistan. And in Malaysia, as a matter of fact, like I said, my home country, even it's illegal to be Shia in Malaysia. So there's even Malaysia Sunni for the most part. And so there's this government propaganda of falsifying the theology of Shia. So when Karima was talking about, we can see the trajectory of where this is going. It's the same theology of intolerance that started in Saudi Arabia but has spread wherever there are Muslims and in all corners of the world, and that's the destructive force. And it's very difficult when our own government does not address human rights abuses and completely ignores this issue and sells weapons to them. And I have to commend the Swedish foreign minister who basically canceled the arms deal with Saudi Arabia on the basis of human rights. And she obviously got a lot of flack for that.
Social media, sorry, I didn't want to miss that question.
Social media. Muslims for Progressive Values would not have grown had it not been for social media, because we were able to promote our inclusive and egalitarian understanding of Islam through social media, and it really caught on fire that way. Yes, on the other end of the extreme is also the extremism and how they promote their ideology, and they are way ahead of us, obviously. There was a time when this is really... the sad state of affairs and how they dominate that even social media stratosphere, where there's instructions on how to stone, how deep to dig the hole, and how big the rocks need to be, and if it's a man, how deep, and if it's a woman, how deep. And the fact that stoning is not even in the Quran is, and the fact that the stoning concept and theology is sort of accepted as Islam, that's the uphill battle that we're going through. So social media is just the beginning of countering those messaging, but we've got a long way to go. And we're very entrenched in social media because, like I said, that's how we grew. That's how our grassroots and that's how our community grew.
Can I ask just on social media for your help in spreading this message, those of you who are on social media, if you have been moved by these stories, if you would think about going home and tweeting about them or writing about them on Facebook or posting the link to Ani's organization's website or to the book website, or there's the TED Talk based on the book called When People of Muslim Heritage Challenge Fundamentalism, we need these stories to be present in social media, because unfortunately our opponents are there. It's a fascinating thing, actually, that movements that claim they want everything to be like it was in the 8th century are so comfortable in cyberspace.
Yeah. Right. Questions?
Could you comment on, I was so interested in your talking about the confusion of the left and the right, the different ways that we in the States or in the West we regard this issue. Could you comment on Ayaan Hirsi Ali, who I find a very confusing figure because she seems to make a lot of sense talking about reform, but is often allied with very rightist organizations here in the States and is often accused of being, you know, anti-Muslim?
So,
wait.
I'm sorry. Yes, of
two
course,
more questions.
Please.
Yeah.
Next question over here.
I'd like to know if you have any thoughts about Iran, or if you did happen to travel to Iran. I mean, remember 79, Iran or Khomeini was the face of fundamentalism, and comparing to what's going on today, it's extremely pale and moderate. And the revolution in Iran was, in my opinion, was the direct result of U.S. imperialism and foreign policy in Iran. So did you happen to go to Iran or interview anybody from Iran? And about the wave of the executions in Iran that going on daily.
Mm-hmm. My son is a sophomore at Davis. I'll have to ask him to over here.
Sorry,
up there on the left.
In the back.
Thank you.
I'll have to ask him to seek out one of your talks when he's on campus, when you're back on campus. Can you mentioned a bit about blasphemy as being and freedom of speech being one of the central issues in the internal discussion within the Muslim community. Can you mention or talk a little bit about a few other issues which are central to the internal discussion within the progressive versus fundamentalist community within Islam, and maybe what a couple of the red herrings are also that kind of get picked up by the news but really aren't significant issues in reality. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay.
Go. So the first question on Ayaan Hirsi Ali, my answer to that is sort of complicated. The first thing I would say is that she has every right to her own views. I don't share them, but if I had her life experience, I might. And if you read her book and learn about her very, very difficult life experience, in some ways, I think where she ended up in terms of her perspective becomes clear. And one of the things that I find very distressing is some of the way in which she is criticized which I find, I try to understand why it is that Richard Dawkins is allowed to write his book, but she's not allowed to write hers. I don't agree with her, and in fact, sometimes I'm criticized for not being more like her, because the far right, this organization called Jihad Watch in the United States, circulated something on internet denouncing my book. It's called "Your Fatwa Does Not Apply Here, Not What It Purports to Be," and what they said is that, you know, how dare I, because I didn't write a book that is against Islam, right? And I thought, this is wonderful. Actually, the right has understood it's not an anti-Islam book, absolutely. And sometimes I get that, you know, why aren't you more like Ayaan Hirsi Ali? I'm not in the same place. I think it's very unfortunate. My guess about her is that what happened is that she showed up in the Netherlands and there was no space for anyone like her on the left. And I've heard her say some actually very intelligent, sensible things, but then she seems to have only been able to find space on the right, which is not a justification of where she ended up. I mean, she ended up in cahoots with some people who have a very nasty anti-immigrant agenda that I want absolutely nothing to do with. But I, you know, she does have the right to her own critique. What I think is a terrible shame, though, is that I think she sometimes positions herself and people see her as kind of the only person with a critique. And she's not at all. There are many people with many different kinds of critiques. And, you know, just to have sort of one celebrity apostate is a mischaracterization of the situation. The question about Iran, thank you for your question. In fact, there is a chapter on Iran. I was advised not to go to Iran because it would put the people that I interviewed about this topic in too much danger. So I interviewed refugees in Europe and in the United States. I worked very closely with an organization called the Abdurrahman Boramond Foundation based in Washington, D.C., that was founded by the daughters of an Iranian Democrat. As I've been speaking French for the last few weeks, talking about the book, that's what I call him in French, but as sort of an Iranian liberal politician who was against the Shah and then against the Ayatollah and was assassinated, his daughters believe, by a hit squad sent by the Islamic Republic, assassinated at their home in Paris. And in his memory, they started a foundation that seeks to document human rights abuses in Iran. And so I worked very closely with them and a community of refugees that they were supporting. And I can say that actually Iran, writing about Iran, it was one of those countries where I thought I knew that how bad things were, and in fact what I found was even worse. And indeed, you're right, there has been an upswing of late, from what I understand, in executions. And as important as the peace process with Iran may be, I think there is also a fear that I've been hearing among some Iranian human rights defenders that no one wants to listen to them now because it's sort of politically incorrect to talk about executions in Iran and so on. You're told that you're getting in the way of peace. And I think that peace with Iran is incredibly important, but I think it can also only be built on and must absolutely include the human rights aspects as well. The final question was about what are the matters of debate? Or do you? I've been talking a lot. Yeah. You take that one.
All right. So on Ayaan Hirsi Ali, I actually feel very sorry for her because of her upbringing. It's incredibly abusive, even though. She's an intelligent woman. What I don't understand is she should have been able to decipher between what is culture and what is the Quran. And the problem that I have with her is that she perpetuates the radical interpretation of Islam as Islam. When you go around lecturing that Islam is problematic because it endorses child marriage, well, actually, that's not what the Quran says. The Quran says that marriage is between two consenting adults. So, based on just that one example, it's impossible for me as an individual and for Muslims for Progressive Values to actually have a conversation with her. And that's unfortunate because it's a discussion that we all need to have. And in American context, it's the right and the left. I think she's very popular. I think she is that critical Muslim voice. But there are plenty of Muslim critical voices. But it seems like unless you're an ex-Muslim, you're not relevant, and that's something for all of you to think about. On the issue of blasphemy internal discussions, as a progressive Muslim community, what sets us different from the Orthodox is that we support women to lead prayer, women to lead men and women in prayer, and when we pray, we don't segregate. We call it Mecca style because we don't segregate in prayer in Mecca. We pray together. families together. So that's what we support in our pair spaces. We also support LGBT rights, and like Karima said earlier, we actually conduct same-sex marriages, Islamic same-sex marriages, and also Muslim women who marry outside the faith. And we are one of those organizations that uniquely support freedom of and from religion. And that is, if you choose to leave Islam, then we completely support your right to do so. And we do that from sacred texts, as what the Quran teaches us. So those are the internal discussions that makes us as a progressive Muslim community quite different from the rest of the pack. Sounds good. All right. How about here on the left, way in the corner? Okay.
Hi. We're hundreds of miles from Washington and New York with the UN, but we're here in LA, and I wonder what you feel the responsibility of us through Hollywood, through TV, film, documentary, the media, can be doing in terms of call to action and just responsibility, since we're here and we're interested. Yeah.
This is a little different. Driving here, to get here, and being passed by a lot of me-ism on the road, it occurred to me that perhaps the most fundamental thing I see in America that's different, when we moved to LA in the 60s, there was common sense, which was kind of a democratic institution of understanding and tolerance. And I think that there's a basic me-ism going on, and I'm wondering if you have any comment.
Me-ism?
Yeah, it's like my space, my road, my car, my driveway, my water, my right, my arrogance. There's something going on in the world. There are too many people. There's a problem. You know, there's a bigger problem. It's fundamental. Just question. Just kind of maybe humorous, but a question.
Do we have time for one more? Okay, there's one up here, John. Okay, no, I guess not.
Coming right away.
That's John.
You know, Karima, I would like you to talk about the title of the book, because I was reading about Bulle Shah, yes. And this connection to that one, I think that would be nice to hear that.
Thank you so much for asking that question, because that was one of the slides that I skipped. So people often ask me, where does the title come from? Your fatwa does not apply here. And I was heavily influenced in the writing of this book by the Pakistani theater. And in fact, I was lucky to meet the director of the Ajoka Theater Company in Lahore, and she gave me a copy of her husband's plays. He's the resident playwright of the theater company, one of which was a play that was very popular in Pakistan called Bulle, which is about Bulle Shah, the 18th century Sufi mystic who was battling sort of the fundamentalists, the intolerance of his day. And there's a wonderful scene when some of the young followers of Bulle Shah are playing spiritual music, a qawwali, and they are approached by a religious leader who has a fatwa, which is a religious order. Fatwas can be good or bad or neutral. There are different kinds of fatwas, but in this case, he approaches the young people who are playing music and says, you have to stop playing music, and I have a fatwa that prohibits it. And one of the young men says, your fatwas do not apply here. And that's where I took the title from. And the point was, you know, that this wasn't my idea. This is centuries of indigenous resistance, as in any of the world's great religious traditions, resistance against intolerance, resistance against extremism, resistance against censorship. And I really wanted to honor that with the title. People sometimes ask me, well, are you against all fatwas? No, a fatwa is simply a religious order. There can be good fatwas, bad fatwas. I'm told in Iran now there's a fatwa against nuclear production. We'll see what impact. You know, fatwas can be good or bad, but the fatwas that we have to oppose are the ones that are seeking to prohibit and to block and to discriminate and to incite violence and so on. And I'm just trying to remember the media question, which I think is very important. I think the media has huge responsibility here, in part because for years the mainstream American cinema in particular mostly showed only stereotypical images of Arabs, Muslims, South Asians, and only negative images, and primarily images associated with terrorism. That's not always true, but it's very often true. How often do we have sort of incidental Muslim or Arab characters who have nothing to do with a sort of a terrorism-related storyline? And I think that absolutely has to change. But what we really need, I think, is a very sophisticated approach. And I think about, I don't know how many of you saw the debate between Bill Maher and Ben Affleck on Real Time last fall, and I actually wrote a piece for the Huffington Post called Why Bill Maher and Ben Affleck Are Both Wrong. So Bill Maher basically wanted to suggest that all Muslims somehow support fundamentalism, and Islam is kind of inherently responsible for all of this. And Ben Affleck's response in anger to that, I think with very good intentions, was to sort of downplay the problem and to say, well, you know, the ISIS supporters couldn't fill a AA ballpark in Charleston. Well, I wish that were true. Unfortunately, it's not. What we need is, you know, a view which is neither of those two, which is much more sophisticated and much more nuanced. I think part of it also is we need to fight for our excellent tradition of journalism in this country, which we are at risk of losing to tabloids and corporations. The really good media coverage that goes in depth, that really can tell some of these stories, is absolutely critical. But this winter after Charlie Hebdo, I got asked to be on television a lot, and they often tell you, please don't answer a question with more than three sentences. You can't really do justice to the topic in a tweet, right? And if we reduce our public discourse to tweets, we're in very big trouble. So I think that's a critical piece of it as well.
I think the media is also just as important in creating that narrative. If you're going to have a negative character, by all means also have a positive character that is of Muslim heritage. I don't think it's very much to ask for. For that matter, I think in order to change the narrative of the perception of what Muslim is and of what Islam is, there's this impression that Muslims don't speak up. Where are they? Where are the progressive, where are the moderate voices? Well, in the Muslim world, they're either in jail or they're killed. And in the United States or in the West, they're not really given the space. So if there's any people in the media here, spread the word. If there's going to be a negative headline, I would really like to see a shift where maybe one perspective or two different perspectives from the terrorists is also included in that negative story. Because truth is, like they say, if it bleeds, it leads. But let's have a positive story spun into that story, so at least we'll get a balanced view. And I guess we should probably end it with that. We wanted to treat you tonight to end this evening with something positive. Karima, are you going to read?
I don't know if this is positive, but you know, I was telling Ani that sometimes I get so angry about the news that then I get delusions of grandeur, and I ended up writing a poem. I am no poet whatsoever, but Aloud asked me if I would say something new that I hadn't said in my previous talks, and I've actually, until Ani heard it this afternoon, I've never read this to anybody, so I thought I would end with this. I make no poetic claims here, but it's a reflection of, I think, a spirit that I want you to understand, feeling that is, I am finding in so many quarters in Muslim-majority contexts now. And this poem, which follows from a poem in the book, which is called Why I Hate Al-Qaeda, which I wrote for the 10th anniversary of 9/11, this poem is called Why I Hate Islamic State.
Karima. One second. Before she reads that poetry,
killed my opening.
So after Karima reads her fantastic, passionate, angry poetry, we're gonna end this program with a song. And I would like to invite you all to sing along, and I'll cue you. So just don't leave yet.
I don't sing in public, but I'm thrilled you're going to, because you have a great voice. And I think it's the kind of the nice antidote to this. So back to this. Why I hate Islamic State. For Jim and Stephen, Alan and Peter, Haruna and Kenji, Kayla and Muadh. For thousands of Syrians, of Kurds who met the same fate but whose names we will never know. For slain Iraqis like Samira, Salah and Naimi, who stood and fell in Mosul. For the Yazidi girls sold into slavery at $10 apiece. For the tarnished name of Islam, my grandfather's Islam, that they have dragged through mud and through blood in the name of a state. For the way they represent Arab failures and American blunders. Because Jihadi John is not human, but one of our sons just the same. Because there is no word but hate for him. And because I can have no hope even for his redemption. because he makes people hate Muslims and fear Islam, and because he makes Muslims fear for Islam, because no paradise he could dream of could ever be anything but hell. If they are Islamic, apostasy is the only answer. If they are a state, rebellion is the only hope. My unbrotherly brothers, we will stand against you. We will stand with those who defy you. God is great, but you are not. And thank God, now we have music.
The song that I'm going to sing tonight is called In My Soul. It's the poetry is written by an old Iraqi poet by the name of I spaced out on her last name. She's a very famous poet, a saint, a Sufi, and her poetry really reflects the Islam of the 700s and soon after Prophet Muhammad died in the first century of Islam, and how inclusive and loving it was. And so I took an English translation of that piece, of that poetry, and adapted to music in the classical genre, because that is not necessarily or traditionally Muslim culture musical genre. So I wanted to do something different with a choral arrangement. You will recognize the inspiration of that music. And there's a part where that goes, ah, and I'm sure you all can sing along in that part. So I will cue you when I do this. Please sing along. It would be a really beautiful ending to such an evening. Thank you. In my soul there is a temple shrine, a mosque, a church where I kneel. Prayer will bring us to an altar where no walls or names exist. Does not illuminate, where ecstasy gets poured into itself, becomes lost. Ha, ha, ha. No time, Almighty. In my soul there is a temple shrine, a mosque, a church that dissolves. Ah, ah, dissolves in God. Thank you.
Aloud is made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the National Endowment for the Arts, and Errant Fox. Additional support provided by the Los Angeles Public Library, the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, and individual Library Foundation members. Media support is provided by LA Weekly, KCRW 89.9 FM, and KUSC 91.5 FM.